Welcome to Supercharge, and this week we are with Will Page. Will is the head of Ride-On, and it's a charity based in Exeter, near Exeter Quay, and they do some really cool and good stuff reusing bikes. I didn't realise, but there's nearly 6,000 recycled bikes out there right now. We're going to talk about a few things, but primarily it's going to be about how the cost of living crisis has had a big impact on organisations and how they change. Before that, as always, Pete, what's going on in Barcelona?
I have absolutely no idea. I've been sat in this little cupboard trying to set everything up for this. So I can't even think of anything interesting to say. So let's just skip on and we'll introduce our guest, Will. How are you doing?
Good. Oh, I was going to say good morning, but you know, people could be listening to this at different times. So hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. It's great to be here.
We're going to start off with an easy question for you. Can you tell us a bit about Ride-On and what does Ride-On do and what's your role?
So Ride-On Cycling for All was formed in 2011 by a wonderful man called Martin Laxton. He was a bikeability instructor in schools, and he kept on going in and finding that the kids had rubbish bikes or didn't have bikes at all. So he persuaded some friends, and Martin's a very persuasive character, to donate some bicycles. He persuaded some other friends to do them up. They gave them to the kids and thought, this is a really good idea for a social enterprise. So Ride-On was born in his shed in Tynmouth back in about 2011. He then persuaded the local council to let him have a lock-up. And so he moved the charity to there. And back in 2014, he persuaded Exeter City Council to let us have our lovely workshop down on Exeter Quay. And we've been here ever since. So I joined the charity about 5 years ago when Martin took retirement, though he wouldn't call it retirement. He's very busy doing other things, as lots of people are nowadays. Day to day, I'm effectively the charity's administrator. So I do, you know, the accounting, the social media, web, everything else, sort of management of the team, strategy, working with our team of fantastic trustees. So the charity has 8 trustees. We've got about 30 volunteers and 5 members of staff. And in the last sort of 6 years, we've grown from annual income of about £80,000 to about £180,000. So we've grown quite quickly. And obviously, there's been an explosion in cycling over recent years as well. So we love what we do. The main thing that we do is that people donate their unwanted bicycles. We work with our volunteers to refurbish them, and then we're able to sell them at affordable prices. But we're more than just a secondhand bike shop. We also work with loads of different partners as well. So we work with the National Health Service, the NHS, on a social prescribing project where people with serious mental health conditions are referred into a program where they go for a weekly group ride. We also work with local charities on a project called Bike Bank, where people who maybe have challenges around well-being or homelessness or other issues can come in and do a 6-week program with our mechanics and learn some bike maintenance skills. We do women's workshop sessions on Tuesdays. So some of our volunteers are set up by Anna and Kirsten, and they've taught over 100 women to fix their own bikes in the last year. There is a stereotype around cyclists, and unfortunately the stereotype is that they look pretty much like me. I'm sort of 42, slightly pot-bellied, slightly scruffy, beardy, so I am the stereotypical cyclist. We recognise that's a challenge we've got to take on. And one of the things we're proud of, the majority of the bikes that we sell at Ride-On actually go to people who identify as women. So, and it's about 46%, and that's pretty much the opposite of bicycle sales trends nationally. So that's something we're pleased about.
And I've just checked your website, and you're not the model on there. So that's promising for others who want to go and have a look. But we'll share your website, Will, across our channels and to our listeners for those who want to donate a bike or who perhaps want to get involved or need to get involved in some other way. But you don't fulfill the stereotype. Don't do that.
My wife is one of your she's a Ride-On customer. I don't know, what do you call them, alumni? We do have she bucks the trend a bit, and you know, so she's been riding a Ride-On bike around Barcelona, which is good, apart from the fact that the brakes are the wrong way around here. So you've been there, you said, 6 years, is that right?
Yeah, so I think it'll be 6 years. Well, so I think it's 5. I have to check my LinkedIn profile. To 5 or 6 years. We've had a little boy. So hang on, no, I can work it out because I started just after my little boy was born. So it will be 5 years at the end of this month. That's an easy way to remember.
So in that time, obviously, we've had some pretty big things going on societally, like, you know, that little COVID pandemic, and more recently, what some people call the cost of living crisis. So do you think major changes like that are impacting what you see as a community organization?
Massively. And there's two different sort of big challenges that you've identified, Pete. So the first one around COVID, I mean, that was an extraordinary time to be in a workplace in terms of the amount of change that happened in such a short space of time. And I think there was obviously a lot of sadness and a lot of terrible things that happened during that period. But I think one of the positives that I would draw from it is it shows how quickly organizations can change in response to a big challenge. Now, a lot of that was forced, and the threat was very real because people were concerned for their own lives and the lives of their colleagues. And that's what drove a lot of that change so quickly. But positive from that is it does show that it can be done when there's a big threat. And so, you know, humanity can pull together and do lots of things in a short space of time. So what did we do? So, you know, in terms of what we did at Rydon, I think there was a few things that we did quite well in terms of how we responded to COVID-19. The first thing we did is we focused on our core business. So we said, you know, what are the main things, you know, the main thing that we need to be able to do to keep the doors open? And that was to focus on selling the bikes. And we all need to think about social distancing. So we moved to an appointment-only sales model, and we did that pretty much straight away. Lots of bike shops didn't do that to start off with, and indeed they copied us. And we found that was really good because it meant before, when you're dealing with customers walking in off the street, you don't really have any information about them. And so we moved to an online booking system. So we were able to find out how tall they were, the kind of cycling they were thinking about doing. And that means that we could then look at our pile of donations and go, well, that customer needs that kind of bicycle. So it became very efficient for us in terms of our mechanic time and being able to provide a service to customers. So our sales went up. It also meant that we weren't dealing with people who were coming in off the street browsing as well. So for us, that was really, really helpful in terms of, you know, productivity of the bike sales. The negative was we stopped doing things like our volunteering. So that ability to teach, if you're going to teach someone how to fix a bike, you need to be, you know, working, standing next and working together on a bike. And that wasn't possible with social distancing. So we paused our volunteering program for at least a year during COVID. We also stopped doing our training courses as well that we offer to the public. So yeah, we lost a lot of our activity, but you know, by focusing on our core business and making sure that was successful, that kept us going, and then we were actually able to grow off the back of it. I think another thing we thought about as well is in terms of focusing on the core business, in terms of how you manage that change process as well. And because there was a lot of big change happening, when you've got big changes and you know the sector that you both work in, there's a lot you need to consult really widely, make sure that everybody's involved with those changes. Because it was a crisis, we kept the group quite small, just had our trustees and just had our managers involved in those discussions. So we're quite a small organization, so that does make it a little bit easier. But we didn't include our volunteers, we didn't include customers, we didn't include partners, some of whom are, you know, paying us a fair whack every year for, you know, training contracts or whatever. We just focused on that group of people. So we were able to be quite agile and make decisions quite quickly. And that meant, I think, we closed for 5 weeks because I think a lot of organizations did that just where everybody, you know, was looking around and whilst discussions were taking place about deciding what we were going to do. But then we cracked on. And I think the third thing that we did that was, you know, that I think we're quite pleased about was we thought about our supply chain as well, because we recognized it wasn't just causing us problems. There were things that we needed to be able to operate. And so we bulk ordered testing kits right from the start. As soon as those became available, we got as many as we possibly could. Cleaning materials as well. We're still using some of our cleaning materials that we ordered in the first month of COVID, but also supply of new bike parts. Whilst we save a lot of parts off old bikes, things like, you know, vital cables, brake pads, we back ordered, you know, normally by COVID, our monthly order for parts would generally be about £500-£750. We ordered £2,000 worth straight away at the start, and we went from having two part suppliers to having about 10 very, very quickly. So we were very quick to see that there was a problem there. The cycling industry has, you know, it was a challenging time during COVID because of supply chain challenges. And you might remember when the Ever Given shipping container got stuck in the Suez Canal, everybody in the cycling industry was just going, no, because it was full of bike parts and bikes from Asia. And it wasn't just that ship. It was the 400 other ships that were backed up behind it. So it has been a challenging period for the cycling industry, particularly the smaller organizations like us who don't have the space to carry lots of stock. Some of the larger traders did very well, you know, people like your Halfords, etc. But for us, it was challenging. But I think those are the three things that we did well in terms of COVID. I'll give you a chance to say something. I've talked for a while there before you move on to the cost of living crisis.
Yeah. So my assumption with cost of living is that it kind of shifts the market for bikes and things like that down, so that people are looking perhaps not for, you know, your top of the line bike, but they're looking for other ways to be able to move more cheaply as well. And I assume then that that's got an impact on an organization like yours. I have no research. I have no idea whether that's a correct assumption. So please challenge it.
So I think that the demand for bicycles, and there's lots of research that shows this, is a lot more adults want to own a bicycle than actually own a bicycle. And that was true for COVID. That's been true for a while. And what happened during COVID was that there was an opportunity because people weren't really allowed to do anything else if they wanted to go out, apart from cycling became really popular. And people actually had the time and also the money because of furlough, they weren't able to spend their money on other things. So that increased the demand for bikes. And that then followed through into what's called the cost of living crisis. Now, I don't think that's had an impact on us in terms of our bike sales, because the demand for bikes for our services has always been high, because we're offering an affordable product that's refurbished, that's sold with a warranty. You can't get that from secondhand bikes. You know, if you go in on Facebook, go to buy on Facebook Marketplace or from other suppliers. So we've got there's a higher degree of trust there when you're buying a secondhand bike from us, because we're a charity as well. So there's always been a very high demand for our bikes. So the cost of living crisis hasn't really impacted on that. I think potentially where it has had an impact is in terms of donations. So people are much less likely to donate their wanted bicycles if they need the money. So they're selling them privately. So there's a lot more private sales, secondhand bikes going on. But then that said, because more people who are wealthier are buying bicycles, they're then donating us their unwanted bicycles. So we're getting, I would say, more high value bikes, which we can then make more of a margin on when we sell, even at our prices, and which then help to cover our overheads. Now, cost of living crisis, that's really interesting, because, and we've talked about this a bit before, Pete, I really don't like that phrase, because I don't think that we have a cost of living crisis. I think what we have is a greed and inequality crisis, and that's been going on globally, and in particular in the UK, quite a long time. So for us as a charity that has a mission providing affordable bikes, you know, there's definitely a need for our services, which we're focused on, but I do feel uncomfortable when I hear phrases like the cost of living crisis, because it's a cost of living crisis for some people, but not for everybody. And that's a question of fairness. And that's something I think it's important to reflect. So I don't like the phrase at all. And I say it's a greed and inequality crisis, because if there was a fairer distribution of that wealth, then a lot of the problems that people are experiencing in terms of being able to pay their energy bills or get food, those problems would be eased substantially. How can we help? What's our role? Well, we definitely help, because, you know, cycling is a great way for people to save money. So, you know, once you've got the average price of one of our adult bikes is about £160-170. The cheapest is about £120. And that's a fully serviced bike. So if you oil the chain, if you're able to keep it in the dry, which can be a challenge for some people, but if you're able to do those things, then it will keep you going for years. And if you can compare that to the cost of a bus ticket or the cost of running a car, it's a substantial financial saving for some people. I say we also teach the maintenance courses as well, and we do those for people who are referred in from other charities, and that can help people with their self-sufficiency, because then they don't have to pay a mechanic to service their bicycle for them. They can do it themselves. On Wednesdays, we run bring your own bike sessions, where for a donation, people can come in, use our tools or workshop space. So that's another way that we can help as well. So there are a number of things that we do as a charity to help people with those costs. And indeed, the wider charitable sector is doing lots of really good work in terms of supporting people with the challenges around homelessness, food poverty. There's great organizations like Citizens Advice who work across all those areas. So yeah, the community sector is doing a lot to support people with those challenges.
I was just
challenges.
Looking online, Will, while you were chatting there, and I was actually amazed by how expensive bikes are, and I just didn't realize that a new bike could actually be as expensive as it is. Even some of the cheapest on the well-known websites are pretty pricey. A quick switch over to Marketplace and other well-known second-hand good retailers. They're so expensive, aren't they? And I can see how it stops people actually having access to do these things.
And there's some big social challenges as well, because I think that's a very good point. And I think I would say that bikes are, whilst they may appear expensive, if you look at the money that you'll save through switching to cycling, for example, if you use a car as your primary form of transport and you switch it to bike, you can save an awful lot of money. So we went car-free about 3 years ago. We gave up our car. and putting it down on a spreadsheet, I reckon it saved us, even off the cost of hiring cars when we need them and public, you know, spending more on buses and trains, we save about £2,000 a year. And that's where me and my other half both work. I say, oh, you know, a little boy's gone to nursery and he's just starting school. So I think whilst the, you know, bicycle can be an expensive initial investment, what you save over the years, if you look after it, is substantial. I think there are some challenges. So I think bicycle storage is a particular challenge, and it's one really that we've not, you know, as a country, that we've not really got into. So, for example, people who live in houses of multiple occupancy, the only place that they've got to store their bikes will be if there's a shed provided in the garden, which most private landlords won't do, or indoors, which normally means that you're blocking a fire escape, which you're also not allowed to do. And most of our storage space in the UK for transport is used to provide storage for private cars. So if you walk down a residential street in any city in the United Kingdom, it's full of parked cars. And it'll be great to see more on-street bike lockers so that people who perhaps can't afford, you know, their own house or their own home and can't afford to provide private storage for their bicycle can actually use that as part of the public realm in the same way that huge amount of storage is provided for private cars. Now, that's a difficult thing politically, again, because if you take car parking away, there'll then be an outcry from drivers. But if we want to see a modal shift away from private cars to bikes, which has that benefits not just in terms of pollution and congestion, but also in terms of saving to the NHS. You know, obesity costs the UK, I think, about £8 billion a year. So it's a huge sum of money. We need to see more of these changes happening across our cities and towns in the United Kingdom.
I'd like to just change tack slightly on parking, because what I'm interested to ask you is, we all know you can see so much stuff on social media of drivers and cyclists fighting with each other. It's endless entertainment. But, you know, you've got plenty of skin in the game there. And I think you must have some idea when you're having conversations with people who are resolute drivers and will never give up their car, what works? Because I don't think it works if you, well, I would just say some things that cyclists might do might not work, right? But you must have an idea what kind of ins you can get to start making people think about it in a different way.
That's a really good question, Pete. So it's a really difficult conversation to have, because it's often a values change is what you're asking people to consider, because a lot of people hold the value that the, you know, and it's quite understandable. I'm not criticizing or attacking those people. It's a different set of values that I have. We all have different values. That's okay. But a lot of people really value their cars and see it as a personal freedom, and they've got their driving license at 17, and they've worked really hard to get their cars, and so they very much value it as a right. And so once you start to get into those changes around values, it becomes very difficult, because you can't use necessarily data or evidence to argue that case, because if it's not true to people's values, that data, they'll just reject it and say that data is not true, that's not my experience. So I think the key thing to do, and this is learning from the experience of other parts of the country where perhaps they're a bit further on in terms of making some of these changes, is you need to try and find common ground. And one of the ways that we can find, one of the areas where potentially you can look at finding some of that common ground is around, for example, finding clean air for children. So who could disagree with the idea that we need to ensure that children have access to clean air? Now, some people still do disagree with that, but it's about trying to find those commonalities, those shared things. And that's true when you're managing any changes in an organisation, is if you look for where have we got things in common, where do we share objectives or aims or goals, and then you try and tell a story that will help people get there. You build a relationship. And that's some of the things that people have learned around. So the rollouts, for example, of low traffic neighbourhoods in other parts of the UK, is that rather than going in and saying, look, there's data that shows that shops, that, you know, retail income from shops goes up by 30% and that retail vacancies goes down by 20%. If you turn it into an LTN, people are just going to go, what? Whereas you should have a conversation around values and try to find some shared values that you can use to underpin and explain those changes, that can be a more positive way. But I don't think there's an easy answer, because if there was, we would already have a lot more of these changes, rather than it being the slightly slow, tricky process that we're experiencing at the moment.
Something I would just add to that I've seen actually in Barcelona was that obviously saying to people that we're going to remove all parking from your street is a fairly extreme position to start with. So they what they've done is started just having an annual event where in one road they'll take all of the parking and turn it into an urban garden or in it something as a community event, just to show A, what you can do with that space differently, but also that if you do different things, it can benefit the community as well. And I think that is another way I see is trying to get people from those kind of absolute positions when you're changing anything, let alone parking, is that if they are strongly resisting it, just running a little experiment sometimes to see if it will convince them is a good thing. The other thing I was just going to say on parking is that it always fascinated me that we could be talking about any change coming up, any organization almost, and you'll do like massive presentation, and then the first question always is like, yeah, I don't care about that. What about the car park? I know it's like, for some senior leaders, it's like, why? Like, what is this issue? But as you say, you know, it's something that is fairly essential to people being able to operate and move around in the way that they do at the moment. So
it's something I was thinking about, you said earlier as well, was like, I suppose if you go back far enough, people used to live and work pretty close to each other. Where they would work would be walking, or in the very least, you know, cycle. The expansion of, you know, cities, towns and counties now probably means that that's harder. So the demand for cleaner transport, and that in its own right links to well-being, I guess, must be increasing. Are you seeing that in terms of the organization you're running? Is the demand getting bigger?
Oh, definitely. And I think that demand has always been there. And I think the changes that councils are starting to make nationally and locally are starting to enable that change, particularly with the changes in infrastructure. So through putting in more safe cycle routes in urban areas and cities and towns is definitely helping to encourage that change. I think, Pete, that's a great question. I think, Pete, you made a really good point as well. It's about showing people what the difference looks like. And without making those changes and not having those tests and those pilots, it can be very difficult for people to see what it looks like. A little story, Chris, because this relates to your question. So I live in a council estate in Exeter, Wanford, that was built in the 1930s when they closed down the slums in the West Quarters. And these council houses were built as part of the urban garden movement. So I lived on the Poets Estate, and it's the Poets and Trees Estate, because one half of the estate is named, all the streets are named after poets. The other half are all named after trees. And I actually, the Willie's Foundry was the big employer. And so lots of staff who made that move all worked at Willie's Foundry. So every day, and Willie's Foundry is close to where our workshop is down Exeter Quay. So every day I'm actually making the journey on my bicycle that all those people who would have had very physically demanding jobs made every day, and they made it on foot because I use the same suspension bridge. There's a little mini suspension bridge for pedestrians and cyclists that was built in the 1930s by Willie's for their staff to use to come from the Wanford estate that I live on now. So it just goes, you know, and I think when we, about 50% of car journeys in the UK are less than 2 miles. So in urban areas, whilst we talk about the busy and demanding lives that people have, and I say, me and my other half, we have a child, we both work, we have to take them to school, we have to nursery, we manage to do it all using our bicycles. I think of those guys back in, because they would have been largely men back in the 1930s who would have been working in industrial jobs on the Marsh Barton Estate in Exeter, who would have been walking and cycling exactly the same journey that I'm walking, without the same access to healthy, balanced diet, without the same healthy lifestyle information I have access to, all those benefits and privileges. If they were able to do it, then surely we should be able to do it well, with all the easier things that we have. And okay, some things were different back then. So one partner would have stayed at home and look after and brought up the kids. Life expectancy would have certainly been worse. But you know, I know for me, it has a positive impact on my well-being, the fact that I make that journey by bicycle or on foot to work every day, in the same way that people did in the 1930s before the mass rollout of the car.
So with the increase then in the demand that you're seeing and the growth that you've experienced over the years, how has that changed your approach to how you communicate your story, your ethos, your approach, your narrative to the potential users? Because yeah, growth comes with challenge, doesn't it? You have to grow internally as well as you do in terms of product. So what's been the journey you've gone through there, Will?
That's a great question, Chris. So I think one of the initial challenges that we had, and I think lots of charities really struggle with this, and it comes back to the question about profit, the purpose, is I've most of my experience before joining Rideon was working in much larger charities, so ones with multi-million pounds turnovers, where there's a real focus on terms of making sure that you had 6 months income in the reserves, making sure that you had proper processes, so in terms of, you know, monthly financial tracking, so you can see how you're performing against your financial budget. And so introducing a lot of those things at Rideon initially was a big culture shock, because there was a sense as, well, we're a charity, we don't need to make a profit, we don't need to make it any money. And actually taking the team on that journey, so where we go, well, actually, well, if we've got more money in the bank, it means that we can employ more staff, and that means we can do more charitable stuff, it means we can take more risks. Having more money gives us that flexibility as an organization. So I think that was one of the challenges that I think that we experienced initially. I think the team are largely on board with that now. But again, it's about finding the balance, because we could, there's bikes that we sell down in the workshop. If we went on Facebook Marketplace or onto eBay, we could sell them for a lot more money, but then we're taking them away. We're then obviously losing sight of our charitable mission, which is about providing those bikes at an affordable level. So what we do is we try to find the balance where we perhaps sell the nicer bikes at a price that's closer to the market rate, and we make sure that we try to keep a number of bikes at affordable price. We also have an affordable bike scheme where we give away a couple of bikes every month as well to people who are nominated by local charities. So that's one of the challenges in terms of, you know, growth in a small charity. I think in terms of other difficulties that we've had, I think, you know, I think we might be getting into technical stuff that's probably not for anything, but you know, premises is a huge challenge for us, because as you get bigger, as a charity, we don't pay a commercial rent. So we pay a peppercorn rent. We're tenants of the city council. And as we got bigger, we need more space. And we can't realistically afford a commercial rent. Whilst we've got 6 months income, we've gone from having £20,000 in the bank, we've now got about £90,000 in the bank. You know, I mentioned our income at the start. So we've got comfortably 6 months income in the bank. We can't, a commercial rent for our current site would be, I mean, maybe £50,000-£60,000, and we're paying considerably close to nothing in terms of our rent. So that's a real challenge for us as well moving forward. And it's one we're very focused on at the moment. I hope that answered your question, Chris. So it was more focused on change, wasn't it? So I talked about the profit v purpose, and I think that's probably the main challenge that we've experienced in terms of that growth. I think the other challenge as well is in terms of, and this is a challenge that's true to lots of organisations, in terms of recruiting, retaining and training staff. And there's a shortage of bike mechanics. I think this may be a national challenge, but it's particularly a problem in Exeter. So one of the challenges that we've got around the cycling industry is that our industry is seasonal. There's a higher demand for our services in the summer than there is in the winter when the weather gets bad. So staffing that model in terms of the fact you need to have people who are qualified and experienced bike mechanics. So you can't really employ people on a casual basis. You've got to employ people permanently. So storage space. So we can build bikes in the winter, sell in the summer, but then that's limited by our storage again. So I think that Exeter, I think we looked at the other day, to hit the net zero targets, they need to see a significant increase in terms of the number of people who are cycling. At the moment, in the summer, if you take your bike into a bike shop, you're looking at, say, a 2 to 4 week wait to get the servicing work done. And if your bicycle is your only form of transport and you've only got one bicycle, that's not feasible. So having more trained, qualified bike mechanics and more bike shops is going to be something that the city's going to need to see that modal shift. But if you're only able to generate high levels of income during 6-7 months of the year, that's a challenge for the cycling industry as a business model. What can we get staff members, team members doing that's productive during the winter? And that's a strategic challenge for us and for other bike shops, and one that we're thinking about at the moment as well.
I've been watching some videos online recently, you know, time killers as they are, where they chuck a big magnet into a river and see what they pull out. Are you tempted to do that, see if you've got any bikes in the X near where you are?
Well, funnily enough, there are actually a number of people who do that, and they're employed. I think, I'm not sure who employs them. It might be the local council. It might be one of the local maritime organisations to go and do that sort of magnet fishing. in the river, and they do occasionally find some bicycles. So yeah, but sadly, they tend to be too far gone by the time they get to us. Our mechanics are occasionally tempted when there is a particularly troublesome bike to lug it into the adjacent canal, but thankfully we've managed to resist doing that to this point, and all our all our bikes that are unsalvageable, the scrap gets recycled, I'm pleased to report.
I was really hoping there'd be like just some random salvage hunters out there doing it to see if they can make a quick buck. And then to hear it's the council, whilst it's like good to hear and good to know, it just takes the romance out of the whole story, doesn't it?
Well, to take even more romance out of it. So this is something that we've seen during COVID. So prior COVID, the value of scrap metal, I think we were getting about about 20, 30 pounds per it's metric ton from our scrap merchant. It's now about 60 to 80 pounds per metric ton. So the value of scrap has gone up massively. And so that is why there's now an industry around people magnet fishing out of waterways, because, if you've got one person working on that and doing that 5 days a week and collecting that scrap in a trailer or container somewhere and selling it to a scrap merchant, you can actually make a decent amount of money.
There's something for your staff to do in the winter then.
That could be the challenge. Yeah, we could send all the bike mechanics out with magnets to fish in the river. Unfortunately, I think there's not quite enough water to deliver that peat, but it's a nice idea.
We should probably wrap up because we've been talking for quite a while now, but we'd like to finish with one question. So I'll ask her. Will, can you tell us, just to wrap up the episode, what is your favourite biscuit? I imagine in a workshop. In fact, someone told me once, if you ever want anything done in a bike workshop for free, just take a packet of biscuits. So I would hope that you've got a favourite there for us.
So my current favourite biscuit, due to my slight belly that I mentioned at the start of the podcast, is actually an early morning run, unfortunately, Pete, because I'm trying to do something about that. But the favourite workshop biscuit is definitely milk chocolate digestive. That's easily the most popular choice. But again, the cost of living crisis in commas has substantially driven up the cost of chocolate coated biscuits. So now, as looking, and again, I mentioned about the need to be financially prudent. Now, as me as the budget holder, the most popular biscuit is a custard cream, because that is the one of the best value that you can find in terms of buying biscuit and keeping your mechanics happy at the same time.
That is a rise in quality in my book. So
yeah, yes, indeed.
Cool. Thank you very much, Will. It was great talking to you.
Will, it's been great talking to you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.